This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Epilepsy affects more than 3 million people in the U.S., 470,000 of them children. Seizure disorders have been known about for centuries, yet there's still a lot of misconceptions. Joining us today, author and managing director of Wordsworth Communications, Steve Kissing, who's written a book about his experience with epilepsy, and director of the Epilepsy Center at the University of Cincinnati Gardner Neuroscience Institute and UC College of Medicine professor of neurology, Dr. Michael Privatera. Steve, thanks for being here today. Good to see you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good afternoon, Dr. Privatera.
Nice to be here.
Steve, back in 2003, you wrote a book called Running from the Devil, a memoir of a boy possessed. And you just recently turned this into a graphic book. When you were growing up, you actually had this impression that you were possessed because of what you were going through. Why did you think that?
Well, beginning in about fifth grade, I would have been 12. I was having these strange experiences inside my head when the world would seem to turn upside down. Things wouldn't make sense. Whatever I was seeing would morph into other things. So, for instance, I would be looking at someone I knew well, and they would take on the appearance of, say, Abraham Lincoln, for instance.
Wow.
Or in church, someone's playing the organ, and the organ becomes a mailbox. And at the same time, I felt as if my brain was turning to concrete. And these frightened me, and they scared me. And I didn't know how to put into words as a 12-year-old what was happening in my head. And because I grew up on the West Side and in a Catholic bubble and in a world where there's angels and saints and demons and all of this, I concluded after having one of these episodes inside a church that I must have been possessed by the devil. And I held on to that belief for a number of years.
Dr. Privatera, is what Steve's describing, is that common for people who have a seizure, that they have all these I guess call them delusions or whatever you might call them, that happens?
Steve's particular descriptions are pretty unusual for seizures, but they're not unbelievable for seizures. See, a seizure, the manifestation of a seizure, especially at the onset, will be determined by where in the brain the seizure starts. So the more common ones that we hear are people who, for example, have numbness in a hand because it's involving the sensory area of the brain, or twitching of a finger because it's involving the motor part of the brain. What Steve is describing probably is more in the kind of posterior temporal parietal region, where memory and images and perception of the brain are. So when the seizure happens, it's kind of an electrical short circuit. So it's distorting his ability to perceive things as they really are. So that's a pretty uncommon manifestation, but certainly consistent with a diagnosis of seizure.
So how many different forms of epilepsy, how many different types of seizures are there?
Well, we first differentiate focal versus generalized. So focal means that the seizure starts in a particular part of the brain and then spreads. And the manifestation of that will be, again, depending on where in the brain it is. So motor, sensory, visual, memory, perception, spatial perceptual, like Steve talked about. And then there's the generalized type. And that means the seizure starts the whole brain all at once. And those are usually either just staring spells, what we use the term absence now, what some people used to call petit mal. Or the big seizures, the tonic-clonic or grand mal, that's in one, all different words for the same name. So convulsion, tonic-clonic, or grand mal are all the same kind of seizure.
So is it fair to say that different people are going to be affected differently by their seizures?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, like in Steve's case, what we see is people who present to the doctor with their first grand mal or tonic-clonic seizure. And then if you take a careful history, you find that they've had these other episodes that were unexplained, in the case of Steve, like hard to explain to people. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes people would say, you know, I went to the doctor, I felt these funny feelings, these abdominal rising sensations, and I would sort of blank out for 5 or 10 or 30 seconds. And a pediatrician may say, well, let's just wait and see. We're not sure what those are.
Steve, how long was it before you realized that this wasn't, that you weren't possessed, that this was something else?
It took about 5 years. I kept the secret that long. And when I reflect back on that now, I'm somewhat surprised that I was able to do it because I told no one. But I was at an event for young high school leaders up in Columbus. And at the conclusion of that event during a banquet, the same sensation came over me, and I figured it would pass like all the others that had come before. And then I came to in the back of an ambulance headed to a hospital there in Columbus. I had had one of the grand mal seizures.
How did you feel when you realized that you weren't possessed? Was there a sense of relief, or were you saying, no, I'm not possessed, but this is something pretty bad in itself?
You're right. Yeah. It was a mixture of feelings, of course. I kind of felt like an idiot. That may have been the most dominant one. But there was also some fear and, well, what did this mean moving forward? I continued to have the convulsions for several years, so I was unable to drive and had to be careful around pools and the like. And, you know, there was part of me that probably sort of disappointed that I wasn't going one-on-one with the devil, you know, because I thought I was making progress and doing pretty well.
Dr. Privater, how serious a condition is this?
Epilepsy is very serious. There are in many of the cases, we can figure out what the problem is, get a person on the right medication and completely control them. But probably about a third of people, even when the diagnosis is made and an appropriate medicine is chosen, will continue to have seizures. For those people, it can be, even though, for example, someone might have one seizure a month, as Steve mentioned, it means you can't drive. You're going to limit a lot of the things that you do. And then there is a rare but definite risk of sudden death. I mean, people who have epilepsy have an increased risk of death compared to the general population. It's not common. We follow thousands of people with epilepsy at our clinic at UC, but every year there's one or two people who may die from a seizure.
So do we know what causes it?
There's a number of different cases where there are particular causes. So, for example, anything where you injure a part of the brain and you disrupt the electrical system could cause a seizure. So somebody could have a head injury with a traumatic brain injury and have seizures later on. A stroke or a tumor can do it. But in about 50% of the cases or so, we don't know what the cause is. It's what we call idiopathic or unknown. We understand some of the things about that, but we don't understand exactly what's happening in the brain when those seizures happen and why they happen when they do. And that's another big part of it is even if somebody has one seizure a month, it's that unpredictability that really is a key factor for people with epilepsy because 99.9% of the time they're walking around and can do everything like anybody else could except for that 5 minutes when they're having a seizure, but you never know when it's going to happen. And that's the big problem.
Is there a genetic component to this? Do we know?
There is some genetic component, and it differs for the different types. In the generalized seizures, it's a little bit more genetic. But even so, there's only very rare syndromes of epilepsy where it's really penetrant and you see it generation after generation. So there is sort of a genetic component in that someone with epilepsy is more likely to have a child with epilepsy, but it never would reach, for example, 50% or even 25% risk of children.
Steve, what was life like for you? You said you had to be cautious about driving. There were a lot of things that you had to really be careful about doing. I mean, how did this impact your life?
Yeah, what the doctor mentioned really rings true for me in the sense of always being, to a certain extent, on guard. And there was that constant pressure of just that little voice in the back of your head saying, you know, at any moment this could happen. So there's a certain stress that comes with that for sure.
You know, you said you kept this a secret. When did your parents finally realize that you needed medical treatment? And how did your family and friends react when they found out you had this disorder?
My parents found out when they got a call from the hospital in Columbus. And when they had heard that I had kept this secret for 5 years, they wanted to kill me, of course, and understandably so. Though their concern for my well-being held them back, of course. But yeah, they weren't too happy about that. And it was interesting because then my friends came forward one after another with, well, you know, there would be times when you would just kind of leave us for a while, And they chalked it up to the fact that I was I had an overactive imagination, or that I would just – I was a little disconnected now and then. And so one of the messages that I would like to communicate, if you're watching your children or, you know, a friend and you notice some unusual behavior like that where it seems they disconnect for a bit, it might be
kind
worth –
kind of like blank out.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it might be worth bringing it to their attention and encouraging them to talk to someone about it.
And Dr. Privatera, is there a certain age that epilepsy manifests at? Is it usually younger people or teenagers? Is there a certain age where you see this the most?
The most common age of onset is in childhood for more people with epilepsy, but it can happen anytime during the whole lifespan. So there are more children that develop, but there are a couple of syndromes that similar to what Steve experienced that happen in adolescence or early teenage. And then some people can develop it at age 70 or 80. And usually it's when they develop it late, it may be related to, for example, an old stroke, or sometimes Alzheimer's disease can increase your risk. But it can happen at any time.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And we got a question by email, or actually by Twitter, from a listener who wants to know if there's been any research that shows that medical marijuana would provide relief for those with epilepsy.
This is the question of the year. I would say that there's not a day in clinic when I don't have somebody saying, oh, my Aunt Bertha told me that medical marijuana is what I need. So the evidence is actually accumulating in a very positive way. In fact, there'll be a series of papers just came out this year where CBD, which is the cannabidiol, so it's not regular marijuana. It's one of the elements in marijuana, one of the compounds in marijuana, but it doesn't have the psychotropic effect. So that's why CBD may be very helpful. So in the clinical trials, it looks like it works just like a good anti-seizure medicine. Now, it was tested in people that had been resistant to other medications. Certainly doesn't look like it's a miracle drug, but it will be another drug that we will probably be adding to our armamentarium probably within the next few years. There's a company developing a pure CBD extract that might get FDA approval within the next year or two.
And Dr. Privatera, before we took the break, we were discussing the question about whether medical marijuana has any benefit for people who are suffering from epilepsy. And you're talking about how it's a component of the of marijuana that actually has the most benefit. And you wanted to elaborate on that some more.
Yes, the cannabidiol, sometimes abbreviated CBD, is the component of marijuana that doesn't have any psychotropic effects but seems to be effective in epilepsy. What I think is important, especially in Ohio, because the two things may be happening at the same time, that there'll be medical marijuana in the dispensaries, and some of that may be sort of higher concentration of CBD than other ones, but still it'll be not all that regulated as compared to what we typically think about with an anti-epileptic drug that really – if somebody says, okay, you're going to get 100 milligrams of this, and you're pretty sure what the pill is 100 milligrams and not 85 and not 120. It's not the safest drug in the world. I mean, there were side effects that we saw in the clinical trial and some drug-drug interactions. So it's not like somebody with epilepsy can just kind of stop their seizure medicines and start taking medical marijuana from a dispensary. I think you have to be a little careful. I would make sure that anybody who's interested in doing this really talks to their physician and really walks through the appropriate steps to really make sure that they get the right treatment and not endanger themselves.
Now, Steve, I wanted to ask you, too. Well, you recently you've released your book as a graphic novel.
That's right.
And I'm wondering what prompted you to go that route.
A publisher in London called Marcosia reached out to me. They had discovered the initial book that I had written. And because in that tale, there's a fair number of descriptions about some of the crazy things that I saw, they figured it would translate well into the graphic novel or graphic memoir package. And so it's been fun seeing it come together in that context. And it should be available on Amazon here in just a couple of weeks.
513-419-7100, and Joe joins us now. Hi, Joe. Go right ahead.
Hi. 15-year-old grandson with autism and epilepsy. And the autism prevents him from being able to recognize when a seizure is about to happen. He's on several different types of medications, and he'll have different behaviors at the beginning of seizures. Sometimes he starts to curse. Sometimes he has unusual body movements. Sometimes he wets himself. Is it possible to be having two or three different types of seizures and then develop even different types of seizure as time goes on?
So the individual symptoms that you talked about certainly would not be rare for somebody with seizures. Some people can have repetitive vocalizations, and sometimes they may be curse words or other kinds of repetitive things. They're probably not different kinds of seizures. They might just be different ways that the seizure spreads within the brain. So in other words, there's one focus where the seizure starts, and if it goes one direction, it may produce these repetitive vocalizations. Losing urine is a common symptom during seizures, so that could really kind of start or spread from a lot of different brain areas. So, it can happen that you do have two separate foci, you know, two different seizure types that come from two different parts of the brain, but that's much less common. I mean, certainly your physicians can look at that on the EEG or in the MRI and probably be able to detect whether there really are two separate foci, what we call a foci or focus of the seizure, or whether it's just a different kind of spread from one place.
And we talk about autism being on a spectrum. Is epilepsy also on a spectrum?
We don't use that term that much, but there are lots of different types of epilepsy that can start in different areas. The autism spectrum really, in many ways, is really kind of a severity type thing. But the incidence of autism and epilepsy together are higher than you would expect from chance. So it's not real common to see them together, but there's more people who have autism and epilepsy than you would imagine if they were completely independent.
Let's talk to Steve, who joins us at 513-419-7100. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I'm a 70-year-old man, soon to be. As an adolescent, about age 17, I developed grand mal seizures, but only had them when I was asleep. And after about 10 years of medication and stuff, I was gradually weaned off. And for the last 45 years, I've never had a seizure. Ironically, I have a nephew who was diagnosed just this past weekend, and he's 28 and has a diagnosis of juvenile epilepsy. There's another word in between I can't remember.
Myoclonic.
And I was just wondering, you know, what would, you know, as a 28-year-old man and getting juvenile, and that's what I had when I was a juvenile, and he's a young man, having it now. And I guess the other question I would have is, can you outgrow this?
So the syndrome that you're probably talking about is something called juvenile myoclonic epilepsy. And the reason that the myoclonic is in there, because many people have these just isolated jerks. They're single jerks, maybe of the shoulders, arms, legs, last a second or less. Those can happen frequently, but then sometimes people will have the tonic-clonic or grand mal seizures. So that's why it's called juvenile myoclonic. Now, it mostly has onset during the juvenile years, so adolescents or teenagers or the time we see it the most. But sometimes those same people can have later onset. So your nephew, for example, at age 28, it would not be rare to see the first seizure at age 28. For juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, roughly half of the people will get complete control of the seizures and can eventually be weaned off the medication and, like you, have a situation where it just never comes back. Although probably those people would be at slight increased risk. So, for example, if you stayed up for 3 days straight because sleep deprivation can be a trigger and drank a lot of alcohol or something like that, you might actually have another seizure because your seizure threshold is probably different than somebody who's never had a seizure before.
Steve, what's your situation? How are you doing these days with it?
I haven't had a seizure in 25 plus years. I was slowly weaned off the medication and haven't had a problem since. They were never able to pinpoint exactly what the cause may have been. They took some stabs. I had an accident on a bike and hit my head. Maybe, perhaps some trauma caused at birth, maybe. But Dr. Privatera has suggested that with all the new advanced high-end equipment they have these days at UC, that they might be able to determine today what they were unable to determine 25 years ago. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. So our MRI scanners are really good at looking at very, very tiny areas. So we can find things. For example, there's something called cortical dysplasia, where nerve cells that should have been in one place don't get there. So they're sort of isolated during the development period, almost like you would see like a birthmark on your hand or something. But that's electrically unstable enough that that could be a seizure focus. And years ago on, for example, CT or an older MRI scan, we might not be able to see it. But now we have that definition. It's kind of like a, you know, a 4G 90-inch television set versus your old TV that you used to watch in the 1970s. It's the same picture, but the definition is a lot different.
Can epilepsy be cured?
In many cases, people outgrow it. Sometimes it's unclear whether the medicines are just suppressing it, which is probably the case most of the time, and not really curing it. But we do have a program for epilepsy surgery at UC, and there are a number of these programs in the country. When we can isolate the part of the brain where the seizure comes from and make sure that it's not in an area that controls motor or sensory or speech or memory, the surgeons can go in and actually take that area out and stop seizures that way. So we've done hundreds of those surgeries at UC in the 30 years since I've been here. And those are really dramatic because these are people that typically have failed multiple different medications, are really at the end of the road. But what we've realized now is that they don't have to be at the end of the road. Surgery and the imaging are so much better and safer now than they were in the past that surgery probably is an option for a lot more people than we ever thought.
Let's talk to Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hello. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have a son who 25 years ago as an infant had a couple of episodes of febrile seizure. They told us at the time that that was not linked to epilepsy. He really hasn't had a repeat of that. But I'm just calling to see if that's still the current thought, that there is no relation between febrile seizure and epilepsy, and maybe an explanation of the difference.
So febrile seizures are seizures that occur only at the time of high fever, usually in children under the age of 5. And 98% of those kids will go on and never have a seizure again. There's a small number that do later develop seizures, and sometimes it's difficult to predict. There's a number of research projects ongoing now to try to figure out which kids who have febrile seizures will later go on to develop. And there, you know, there's something called febrile status epilepticus, where it's not just a single seizure. It's a really prolonged episode that may last 30 minutes or 60 minutes, or what are called sometimes complex febrile seizures. So some of those things seem to increase the risk of later development of seizures. But for the vast majority, you know, the vast majority of kids that develop febrile seizures would never have another one. In fact, I think in some ways that's how I got into this field, because my youngest brother had a febrile seizure in the car when I was there. And I remember my mother, who was a nurse, who was always calm, was just freaked out by the seizure itself. And I'll never forget that moment.
So what's the proper way to help somebody who's having a seizure?
So for a tonic-clonic or grand mal seizure, really what you want to do is roll the person on their side so they don't aspirate anything. Do not stick something in somebody's mouth. You know, they're not going to swallow their tongue. Make sure that if they're on a hard surface, that they're not banging their head or something against a hard surface. And for many people who have seizures, if they have a single tonic-clonic seizure like that and they're waking up, they don't necessarily need to go to the hospital. Usually they need to go to the hospital if they've injured themselves, if somebody's diabetic or has other medical problems that may have triggered the seizure, or obviously if a woman is pregnant and has a seizure, that's another reason to go to the hospital.
Dr. Privatera, thank you. And Steve, thank you for being here today too.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Managing Director of Wordsworth Communications, Steve Kissing, who's author of Running from the Devil, A Memoir of a Boy Possessed, and Director of the Epilepsy Center at the University of Cincinnati Gardner Neuroscience Institute and UC College of Medicine Professor of Neurology, Dr. Michael Privatera. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.